So this theme of compassion, you may be familiar with it. It's one of the Brahmaviharas, which we usually translate as divine abidings or divine abodes, meaning it's a state of bliss, not bliss, I don't want to say that. It's these words all are quite loaded for us because divine, the heavenly abodes, it has a sense in the Buddhist terminology of these other realms where these beings of light can live. I like Sharon Salzberg's translation, though. She just says best home. So they're places we can cultivate in our own hearts and minds, in our own felt sense, in an embodied way, that really offer us the best and wisest response to our inner and outer conditions. Offer us a sense of ease and relaxation and kindness and warmth and joy and wisdom. They steer the mind and heart in these directions over and over again. So very powerful as experiences. And what's beautiful about the Buddha's teachings is we can practice them. We don't have to hope that we receive them as divine grace. We don't sort of have to wait for them to happen down the road. We don't not either born with them or not. They're qualities that have an innate capability, but we can actually practice to develop, increase, and more have them be the default response. And that's what I love about these teachings. So I'm sure all of you are familiar with metta or loving kindness, which in our tradition we consider the foundation of the Brahmaviharas, the easiest doorway to enter and the one that's the most kind of flexible and universal. So we always start with metta. This basic sense of goodwill or kindness or friendliness. We translate it as loving kindness, but that word love can be a little triggering. So I like basic friendliness or goodness or goodwill, the sense of welcoming inner and outer experience. So this is metta. Each of the Brahmaviharas has a role to play. And as I said, each of them in itself or combined with one or more of the others is an appropriate response to whatever it is that we're experiencing. So metta is this basic wish for happiness, for well-being. It's a movement of kindness and care, kind of just the very simple that you might say on meeting someone, how are you doing? I care about you. I hope you're doing okay. Compassion, the next Brahmavihara, opens to the suffering. If you ask someone, how are you doing? And they say, not so well right now. It's really hard for me right now. Compassion meets that with a gentle, connecting embrace and says, oh, tell me, how is that? I care about your suffering. What can I do to support you? Let me sit with you as you tell me what's going on for you. So it meets the suffering. It doesn't pull away. Then mudita, the next Brahmavihara, is that of joy. And again, we need the joy. We need that buoyancy, that sense of appreciation and openness. There's an energy, a lightness to the joy that's so essential. And that's when we respond to our own or others' good fortune or happiness. And it's just there's a sense of uplift. I was going to say elation, but that's actually the near enemy. But that it does have an energy, a bright, buoyant energy of just it brings a smile to the face. So necessary. And then equanimity, which is the other Brahmavihara that I thought of teaching on today, but I looked in my notes and saw I'd done a day long on equanimity, one of the more in the last year or so at Marin Sangha. And it's not like we can never have too much, but somehow I just felt the flavor of compassion, this tenderness of heart was going to be more valuable. But equanimity is that balance that's needed in all of the Brahma Viharas that enables us to stay steady, whatever the conditions, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, really challenging or really so full of good fortune and well-being that there can be a tendency, as I said, to get into exuberance. Equanimity helps sustain balance, even when it's really difficult. But equanimity, true equanimity, is infused by the other Brahma Viharas, so it's not unfeeling. It has the warmth and the caring of the compassion. It has a quiet joy, not joy in the sense of a big smile, but just this, the joy of peace, the joy of calm, the joy of steadiness that enables it to be truly vibrant and alive. So all of them are important, and all of them are mirrored in the other. So again, not so separate. They're just different permutations of this same capacity to be fully present for experience and hold it with wisdom and kindness. So all of them we'll be touching on today in different ways. And so, as I said, compassion just seemed like the appropriate Brahma Vihara, if I was going to do a Brahma Vihara to focus on. So much else we could say, but it's really challenging at the moment. Even for myself, I feel so blessed and privileged. I know I'm extremely privileged. I live in West Marin. I have a comfortable home. I can take care of myself. I can keep my work and connections going through online, so I don't have, I'm not able to go out and teach and work in the way I usually do, or even go to meetings in the way I normally would. And I'm able to do that. So I know I'm very blessed and privileged, and yet it's still impactful. And so I only can really imagine, and I try to, again, have empathy and compassion for those people who are incredibly infected by this. I mean, over 200,000 people have died, and each one of those, there's a ripple effect of family and friends and community that have lost, that have grief there at the heart. So it's impactful. The loss of all of the things we took for granted that often brought a lot of pleasure, connecting with friends and family, loved ones, going out to restaurants and movies and theaters and all of the ways that people came together, our choir groups and our knitting circles and our hiking groups or whatever it was, so much has been shut down. Schools, people with children, again, so difficult for them, online learning and all of the challenges and the loss these kids have of losing, all of the richness of school and their graduations and proms or starting college and having it be online. There's just so much, and we feel it. Whatever, if you've got elderly parents or family members who are vulnerable, perhaps have already been directly affected. People who get the virus, we don't hear enough about them, who don't die from it, but have long-lasting effects. There's so much, even as I say this myself, I have to breathe and just hold all of the ripple effects of this. And we get so much information these days. I mean, it's just hard to avoid being impacted. I saw a video the other day of an elderly couple reuniting. And again, I just watched the video. I didn't know the backstory, but it showed an older woman. She's an older woman. She's obviously in a nursing home or care home of some kind. And people were wheeling up what turned out to be her husband. And the story was they had been separated for 6 months because he had COVID and he'd been taken away to care for the disease. And he didn't know, he was very elderly, didn't know if he would survive. And as they met, they were just in tears, and both of them were saying, "I never knew if I would see you again. I've missed you so much. I didn't know if I would ever be able to come back here." And they just held each other and wept. And it just touched me as epitome of all of the loss and grief and separation of what we love. And these tender hearts that, you know, they were just touching each other's faces. So many stories like that. And so I remind myself to open to it, even as I said, that I've so privileged, haven't been directly affected, to let that in, the suffering. And then there's all of the economic ripple effects that so many people, loss of jobs and income and not able to pay the rent or even put food on the table, and the political crazy. I could go on. I don't want to overwhelm you with you. I'm sure you all know the protests against racial injustice. There was, you know, things that were kind of crazy going on, but the basic movement of saying this needs to, we need to pay attention here. There is systemic and institutional racism that's pervasive in this country, and that we need to wake up and see the impact of that on people of color. Really glad that it's happened, that this waking up. And then all the issues that are still there that we don't have the bandwidth to really make it into the news. Climate change hasn't gone away. Social and economic injustice hasn't gone away. Political craziness hasn't gone away. And I don't know about you, but I'm even feeling the end of summer, that poignancy of the light fading, the coolness, the crispness of the air the last few days. It just seemed to change really quickly. And I love summer. I love the warmth and the long days and being able to be outdoors and exercise. And there's this poignancy in the letting go of that and this transition. As much as I'm looking forward to rain and reducing the fire risk that's been so scary this summer, again, there's a sadness to the letting go of the light and the warmth. And again, most of you, I think, are in Marin. I don't know. I can see the weather out some of your windows. Here, it's a very foggy day. So kind of appropriate for a day on compassion, a sense of that cool quietness. Usually there's not much wind when there's fog. And I was talking the other day with a friend who's Danish, and, you know, this loss of the light and warmth. And she said, oh, you need to bring in what the Danish called hygge. And I think it was last year. I don't know if that word was hip. People were talking about it. Do you heard of hygge? It's H-Y-G-G-E. And it basically means coziness. And it's how the people in northern climates deal with their very short days and all the cold weather that they have. They make enjoying the coziness and the warmth of being inside, you know, ideally by a fire with a cup of hot chocolate. You celebrate the change of the seasons, and you turn towards it and you embrace it with this sense of kindness. This is hygge. And it really sounded very compassionate to me. And it's what the Buddha said to do. Don't try and, you know, turn on all the lights and pretend summer isn't ending. No, you turn towards it. You turn towards the suffering, turn towards the difficulty, the challenge. And it's through that turning towards that you actually find the release and the freedom, the happiness, because you're not resisting the truth of things. And so compassion is not turning away. Compassion is not turning away from the inner or the outer suffering. This is what we'll be practicing today. And inherent in it is the motivation to relieve suffering, to end the suffering. And so compassion is this willingness to be with what's difficult. Hold it with this kind embrace, this sense of empathy and caring. And wish to relieve the suffering, but not out of resistance and aversion, making it go away, but actually out of this, you can almost say, transparency, letting it in. It's a powerful state of mind. It has a strength and a capacity that I think all of us underestimate. The power of the human heart to open to what's difficult, hold it with wisdom, and then move to respond. And this is what we'll be talking about today. And again, with all the stories of the suffering, there are also amazing stories of people helping. I mean, the frontline workers, the nurses and doctors and care people in hospitals and nursing homes, I mean, just again, mind-boggling what they open to and put themselves into every day. Just so much appreciation, you know, the burnout, the fear, the all of the emotions they must go through. So many amazing stories. Even the people who are serving us in the supermarket are showing up every day, knowing that there's a risk in doing what they're doing and being willing to do it. Here in our local neighborhood, I think it's in a lot of Marin, there's an organization, I think one woman started up called Good Fairies. And it's just a very ad hoc volunteer thing, but I volunteered, Carol, who lives with me, volunteered, and we just got assigned some elderly people in the neighborhood who were afraid or couldn't go out, and we go shopping for them. It's very simple. We text or call and say, I'm going tomorrow, what do you need? And we just, you know, they pay for the groceries, but we just make that connection with them. And there's many stories of people in this group, in the Good Fairies, doing wonderful things. And hopefully this will continue, because there's need out there all the time, not just in time of the virus. There's a great site, if you haven't found it yet, called coronavirus.org. Anyone know of it yet? Instead of coronavirus, it's the word, the Pali word for compassion, karuna, K-A-R-U-N-A, virus.org. And their mission is to highlight stories of compassion, mainly around the virus, but they're very broad, any stories of people helping people and animals. And so I go on there regularly just to get some uplift. They're just a great place to, when you're feeling that things are really difficult or that people are doing crazy things, there are these stories. I mean, the page, you know, they just keep accumulating them. So one that I just saw the other day, there was a teacher in New Jersey who was a culinary arts teacher, and he made calls when learning went online. He called the students' parents to talk to them about doing it online, and he suggested to parents that they make one meal a day together with the children and send him a picture of the final dish, so they continue the home economics or what they call it, culinary arts, while they're at home. But one parent told him that she was embarrassed to show him what she was feeding her children since she was out of work. So she was not able to really feed her kids what she would want to feed them. So he knew he had to do something. So he started, just out of his own resources, a food bank on his front lawn, and started calling friends, got some suggestions, connections with neighborhood groups and stores and things. To date, he says he has raised more than $30,000 and is now feeding around 200 families a week. And there's this photo of this, just a suburban house, and the front lawn is just filled with these crates that they often have at the food banks. I know our local farmers market has it. 200 of them filling his front lawn, and people can just come and pick up the food that he's gathered from neighborhood donations and local organizations. So just seeing a need, and instead of going collapsing around it, standing up and finding a way to meet it. This is the work of compassion. So there's both. There's so much suffering, and there's these hearts that are moved to connect and to care. And that's what we need to remember. Both are true. Both are true. And the resilience is holding both, not being pulled down and overwhelmed by all the difficulty, but seeing the goodness in ourselves, seeing the goodness that's out there. So This teaching of compassion is so central in the Buddha's teachings. He started by teaching after his enlightenment. You probably know the story. The first teaching to the group of five was the Four Noble Truths, where he just said, this is the way to the end of suffering. There's suffering, the truth of suffering, cause of suffering, the path leading to the end of suffering, sorry, the end of suffering, and then the path leading to the end of suffering, the Fourth Noble Truth. So he was talking right from the beginning about suffering and the end of suffering. And he continued to talk about that for the rest of the 45 years, suffering and the end of suffering. And many of us come to meditation because of suffering. We've had loss or grief in our life, or there's just a sense of emptiness, a dissatisfaction, that the things society tells us aren't meeting our needs. And so we come to meditation and hear this teaching about the noble truth of suffering. What makes it noble? Why is it noble to suffer? Well, it isn't just if we're suffering and we're just flailing around and it's really painful. It becomes noble when we find the path in it, when we hear the teachings and know that there's an end to suffering. And suffering is also the proximate cause for compassion. So compassion is very intertwined with this essential teaching of the Buddha. So compassion is often defined as the tender response to suffering, the quivering of the heart in response to suffering, the meeting, the opening to, the connecting to suffering. And you've perhaps also heard that Buddhism is an encapsulated teaching is that it has two wings, the wings of wisdom and compassion. And I know Thich Nhat Hanh always says, in the body of the bird is mindfulness. This is what we need, wisdom and compassion held with mindfulness. So very central. And even without the Buddha's teachings, you probably know this quality of compassion. It's the natural response of an open heart to suffering. As children, if we saw someone suffering or an animal in pain, the heart just immediately can go out with concern and care and how can we help. So it is a natural response of the heart that's open, and especially the heart that's wise and connected. And for the Tibetans, compassion is actually their core Brahmavihara. As I said earlier, in our tradition, we consider it metta, because metta so easily, this caring, this kindness, when it meets well-being and ease and someone we really connect with, it's so easy to say, may you be well, may you be happy. But when that same kindness meets suffering, it says, oh, I care. Oh, let me help you. Oh, I care about your suffering. Metta can obviously easily open to joy and has to be balanced with equanimity. So as I said, metta and karuna especially are just different flavors of the same act of caring. Metta, more responding to happiness and well-being, wishing ease, and that same care when it meets suffering is compassion. I love the Dalai Lama, who's such a great teacher in this area. He says, I have found that the greatest degree of inner tranquility comes from the development of love and compassion. It's metta and karuna. The more we care for the happiness of others, the greater is our own sense of well-being. Cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling to others automatically puts the mind at ease. It is the ultimate source of success in life. So I love that he always brings it into not just, oh, this is something we practice, but how essential this is for our well-being, how it's actually for our own happiness and well-being that we practice metta and compassion. The more caring there is about others, the more well-being there is inside. And so in this practice of compassion, the Brahmavihara of compassion, Again, it follows a form like metta. And again, I'm sure all of you are familiar with metta because I know you do it every week in your sangha. And you're probably familiar with compassion. But we have, in the way we teach it, these categories of people that we open to. And traditionally, we start with the suffering of someone we care about. And then we hold them with as tenderness. And we offer these phrases, just as we do in the metta. But the phrases of compassion are somewhat simpler. There's often one, maybe two, and its essence is, may you be free of suffering. May you be free of suffering. And all of the variations of that, finding the right phrase can be helpful. You may be familiar with it, have a phrase that works. I'll be offering a lot of different variations, so see what works. I actually find instead of the classic phrase, may you be free of suffering, because that seems a big stretch, right? We've talked about First Noble Truth is there is suffering, there will be suffering. So I like to say, may you be free of this suffering and kind of get more specific. But then all the variations of may your suffering or sorrow or pain or grief, may it be eased. I care about your suffering. May you hold this difficulty with kindness and compassion. The variations of that, all speaking to, I care about you and I'm standing with you within this. So a simple one is just, I'm here for you. I'm here for you in this suffering. And so this can be a natural expression as we practice and lose some of the self-involvement. We see the self for what it is, this kind of story and conditioning that we've told ourselves for countless years, that's really a fabrication, nothing solid there at the sense. As we lose some of the self-involvement, there's more a capacity to be present for others and open to what's going on for them. And you probably know the biggest gift we can be give to someone is actually truly be present for them. Is to sit and listen to them instead of just waiting to tell our story, instead of, having my experience be the number one thing that's important, like to really be present. We know when someone's doing that for us. And so compassion allows us to be more present for all of life because we're not trying to hold the suffering at bay. Our own suffering, press it down. Outer suffering pushes away. No part left out. No part left out of the whole range of suffering. And the other thing we don't want to do is grade suffering. Oh, my suffering is insignificant compared to what's happening over there, or her suffering. She shouldn't complain about that. That's not a big deal. Suffering is suffering. When we feel it, we're sensitive beings. And we open to it and let it have its space. And we've all been touched by suffering, certainly now with the pandemic, with the virus, either intimately touched by it with loss and grief, or just the more pervasive sense of loss that I spoke about earlier. We've all been touched by suffering. And hopefully, I would imagine we've all been held in compassion. We've had someone meet us when we've been suffering with that true warmth and care that we feel, where this other person is just letting us in and holding us in compassion. And so we get to see that we can actually be of more support for others when we are actually balanced. If every time there's suffering and hardship, especially externally or even internally, and we collapse, or we're so anxious and fearful about it, we can't really be of assistance. We can't really help. But we worry that we'll be overwhelmed. And so we try to manage the experience. We try to manage the suffering. We turn away, we repress it. We think we can't bear it. But what's so powerful, especially as we deepen our practice of mindfulness and being willing to be present with what is, we actually find we can. And this is so powerful to do it first in your meditation with things that are difficult that come up from the past or what's happening at the moment, with the difficulties of the body, with pain in meditation or illness or injury, we find we can, that we can be present for difficulty. And this capacity can grow stronger and stronger. This sense of empathy develops a resilience and a confidence that we can meet our own challenges. We've learned to open and to hold them with mindfulness and care, and that we can then bring that into our relational field and just be with someone when they're in difficulty. I like this quote from Pema Chodron. She says, "True compassion does not come from wanting to help out those less fortunate than ourselves, but from realizing our kinship with all beings." So it's a sense of connection. It's not, oh, I'm doing good, I've got the strength, I can help you. But here we are together. And in this moment, I'm opening and connecting to what's difficult for you. And feeling it. Compassion means to feel with. Compassion. Feel with. And so we start. I think what's so important is opening to our own suffering and being willing and able to hold that. Bring wisdom and kindness to it. Recognize this is what it is to be human. We're not alone in suffering. It's a universal truth. There's not something bad and wrong, but there's suffering. This is the way things are. And then from that opening to our own suffering can more easily extend to others. The best gift, as I said, we can give to others is a warm, loving presence, not pulling away. I remember a while ago, some friends really in caring for a nephew who they were close to, who was living in a bad situation. The parents were dysfunctional. They brought him over. They lived quite a distance and tried to give him a stable home, give him work. He was a, you know, young adult. I forget how old he was, in his early 20s, late teens or something. Really tried to give him a stable home. But he can, you know, he'd had a difficult life and he fell back into those ways and got involved in drugs and ended up getting murdered. It was so heartbreaking. Out of the goodness of their heart, they were giving him a stable home. And this was, you know, after he'd been with them 6 months or a year. So hard, all of the conflicting emotions about that. But what was also hard for them is how many of their friends couldn't deal with how challenging that was and just either dropped them or could never talk about it. And so when we would come and say, "How are you? This must be so hard. And, you know, what's happening?" Because it was messy, of course. They were so grateful to them and talk to them about this. So just that willingness, we couldn't solve anything. We couldn't fix that situation. And so this capacity to be present, so powerful. I've done a month actually of intensive compassion practices at Brahma Vihara, and it was beautiful and profound and incredibly difficult. I chose as my suffering person my father because my mother had not long died. And they'd had a long and basically really happy marriage. I mean, it had its ups and downs, et cetera. But in her loss, his love for her became more apparent to me. I hadn't quite, they didn't show it that much, you know, married 60 years or something. But just feeling his grief and heartache, it was heartbreaking. And the loneliness, the like, where's she gone? His faith, he was a Christian, and their solace always was, "We'll be together in heaven." And I remember him saying, "I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I'll see her again." It was just heartbreaking. He said, "She was the only woman for me. He met her when he was 16. It just broke my heart. So in using him as my suffering person was incredibly difficult. And I would feel when I would go into what's the near enemy of compassion, which is pity. And pity is when we hold the suffering at arm's length, kind of look down on it. Stephen Levine has this great quote. Stephen Levine, that teacher of A Year to Live, would talk about death and difficulty. He said, when your fear touches someone's pain, it becomes pity. When your love touches someone's pain, it becomes compassion. So with my dad, I would feel the pulling away, all the moving towards, but wanting to fix it, wanting to take away his suffering so he didn't have to feel it and I didn't have to feel it. This is not true compassion. And then, of course, the far enemy I didn't feel towards my dad, but we can feel variation of cruelty, of wanting someone else to suffer. In the political realm, it can be so hard not to fall into that when certain people say and do crazy things or get sick. You know, the mind can go to, oh, I hope they really feel this. But I think actually for more of us, so the near enemy is usually pity, but I think we more commonly feel or can feel the fixing mode, wanting to fix it so it goes away as a near enemy. And then the far enemy, instead of cruelty, it's the shutting down, the heaviness of heart. We get tired of it. We want it to go away. Buck up, you know, get over this, push it away, or just shut down so we don't feel it. So we want to be aware of these. They can be very gross movements, but sometimes they're just subtle, energetic. The separation into the pity out of fear or anxiety, worry, or the fixing mode. If I could just do this and that, or if they would do this and that, it would go away. We need to be open to it. And that's why I made sure I had a Kuan Yin here this morning. She is known as the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And it said that she hears the cries of suffering of the world. She hears both the 10,000 cries of suffering and the 10,000 joys of the world. But her heart stays open and balanced because she has equanimity. And she's often depicted in this pose as this one here, the statue I have. It's called the Pose of Royal Ease, where one foot is up and her arm is out like this. And she's kind of relaxed, but she's ready to move into response. So she embodies both this settledness. Her face is usually calm and in repose. The body is relaxed, but she's ready to move in response. So she's the epitome of what's possible with compassion. But we don't have to look at archetypes. So many, as I've said, models for compassion. Mother Teresa, as complicated as she was, she did so much good. Thich Nhat Hanh, who may now, such a great teacher, may now be in a dying phase. Rosa Parks, the initiator of the civil rights movement. I love this phrase, this statement she said, I would like to be remembered as a person who wanted to be free so other people would also be free. This movement of compassion, not just for our own freedom, so others can be free. So there's a lot more to say, but I want to move us on to a practice. So the normal sequence of compassion in the traditional way I've been taught is that we start with a suffering person. But I'm going to change that up this morning, because I think to open to our own suffering is so profound that it then gives us the capacity to open to others. So we're going to start this morning with compassion for ourselves. And we'll use phrases, as I spoke about, or if you're more familiar, or at times you may want to just use what we call the radiating compassion, where you may be holding yourself, having a sense of directing the compassion, but not using phrases to make the practice, to hold the practice, but just resting in this sense of compassion. And then this afternoon we'll move into the other categories. And I want to acknowledge Dr. Kristen Neff. Again, some of you may be familiar with her work. She's a practitioner in our tradition, and she's taken the teaching, the Brahmavihara of compassion, and really seen how important it is to direct it to oneself. So she's created a whole movement, you could say, a whole teaching tradition she calls mindful self-compassion. So she has a website and there are trainings. I'll talk more about that. But I took this teaching from her, inspired by her. And I think it's so helpful to just acknowledge when things are difficult for ourselves. But it is part of our tradition of compassion. So it's just shifting the focus a little to start with that. But I want to share with you to see how helpful this is. A poem from, and I've been reading from this book in all of my teachings, The First Free Women. It's the poems of the early Buddhist nuns, inspired by the early Buddhist nuns, by Maddie Weingast. Not quite a translation, but he captures the essence of these women who were disciples of the Buddha in his presence, and their enlightenment poems. And they're all very brief, but they're all powerful teaching. So highly recommend this book. So this is from Grandma Sumana. So she's obviously old. And she says, after all those years looking after others, this old heart has finally learned to look after itself. Each act of kindness, a stitch in this warm blanket that now covers me while I sleep. So she said, you know, she spent a life caring for others, compassionate about others, finally learned to look after itself, herself. But she's supported by all those acts of kindness. Each act of kindness, a stitch in this warm blanket that now covers me while I sleep. Thank you, Grandma Sumana. So I want to start, as I said, with the practice of mindful self-compassion. I've talked longer than I thought. I was hoping to finish 15 minutes or so ago, and I still didn't say everything I wanted to say. But if you need to stand up or sit down, hopefully you're in a comfortable place, get a sip of water. We'll begin now with a guided meditation.